WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. What do you do when a stranger stops you on the street and asks you for money? Do you give? Giving to panhandlers is very controversial, even among homeless activists. Some people think panhandlers turn the public against the homeless population in general. Some think that giving to panhandlers has created a group of professionals who make hundreds of dollars a day. But others believe that to coldly walk past a person in dire need turns us into something less than human. Our program today is about panhandling, the controversy surrounding it, and the mix of compassion, skepticism, and fear so many Americans feel when they are asked for money on the street. My first guest, Nicholas Davidoff, is the author of an article called The Business of Begging, To Give or Not to Give, published in April in the New York Times Magazine. His article is about the panhandlers who work the New York City subway system. Panhandling is illegal in the New York subways, but this wasn't much enforced until the new mayor, Rudolph Giuliani, took over the office in January. In his article, Davidoff showed that panhandling had become a kind of performance art on the trains, a succession of people dramatically telling their tragic stories and publicly displaying their scars and wounds to generate sympathy and money.
It's like a parade, and that's exactly why Mayor Giuliani and the MTA, which is responsible for subways in New York City, decided to crack down on panhandling in the New York subways because there are just so many people. It became oppressive. The reason a subway became so popular for panhandling is that it's a confined area. It's a closed space. So you're forced to listen to people asking for money. You can't walk around. You can walk away from someone who's asking for money on the street. You can't walk away in a subway, or it's very difficult to. You have to go in between cars, which is dangerous, and most people don't want the inconvenience. And when they have this stage, they can tell you anything they want. If they're good, many, many people reach into their pockets, and that turns into a lot of money. There are people making $300 a day on the New York subways panhandling.
There's somebody who you call Charles Crenshaw. I don't know if that's his real name or an alias for the article, but you describe him as being one of the originators of the rap. What does he do? What's his specialty on the trains?
Well, he's pretty lachrymose. He's tearful, and he's, you know, after you've heard it a few times, you don't believe it. But the first few times, you know, that you encounter him, he's very believable because he's so fervent in his approach, which is he'll walk into the car and he'll say, "My name is Charles Crenshaw," and he'll go on like that as though he were almost weeping and in tears, and he'll talk about how badly he feels to be asking for money, that he doesn't want to be in this situation, that he doesn't want to hurt anybody, that he doesn't take drugs, that drugs kill people. He urges you to tell your children not to take drugs and just help him out because he just wants the money for food. He's really poor, and would you please help him, please? And he'll beg, and he'll sink to his knees, and he'll implore, and it is quite a performance.
What did you find out about him and his real predicament?
Well, this is the thing, that most of the panhandlers that we spoke with were pretty guileless. I mean, they told us about themselves, you know, in fairly explicit terms. And Charles said that he'd been a criminal, that he'd been in jail. He said to me that he used to mug people like me for a living downtown in New York City, and that now he is doing this because his career as a shoplifter ended when his partner, I can't remember, either died or was sent away to jail. There was one phase where after he was mugging people, he was a shoplifter, and he'd make $500 or $800 a day shoplifting, he said, in department stores. So now he does this. But he tells you very frankly that most of the money that he makes, he spends on drugs, on heroin.
Where does he sleep?
He sleeps on either subway platforms or in subway cars.
So he is genuinely homeless?
So he says, yeah. And people who know him confirmed this. That's what they said. Which is interesting because he operates on the L train, which is a train that goes through many of the poor working class neighborhoods in Brooklyn. And the people who give him money on the L train, generally, I would guess a great many of them aren't making as much money each day as he is. He makes a lot of money every day. He can make, you know, $200 a day easy.
Someone else who you write about was crippled in one leg and had some kind of looked like a skin disease on that leg as well.
Well, I don't actually think that that's a skin disease. He told us that he does that with a fork. He makes his leg. He's Puerto Rican. His name is, his nickname anyway, is Rico. His name is Jose Santos. And he told us that if he scrapes his skin raw with a fork, it, well, he didn't say it looks more convincing, but we thought that's what it meant, because although he comes through the subway cars on crutches and he doesn't really use his right leg, the fact is that other people around the subway station, including people who work in the subway station, told us that when he leaves the subway station, he doesn't use the crutches anymore.
What's his rap like when he goes through the trains?
His rap is lengthy and sometimes aggressive, and it's something like, "Oh, mira," which means look at me. He'll say, "Ladies and gentlemen, thank you immensely. I hope you're having a good day and are in good spirits." And then he'll say things like, "I'm under mental and physical stress. I suffer mental impositions." And then he'll say, "It comes from nowhere. It's like a breeze. It makes it hard for me to plead with you for change." And then he'll lean into people's faces. He'll say, "I want to be sure you hear me," you know, when he's screaming. And he'll say, "You know, can you hear me calling? Please, please, I really, really need your help, please." And if people don't give to them, he'll scream, "They don't give. Why don't they give to me?" And it can be, at minimum, pretty obnoxious. And the first time you hear it, it might be sort of entertaining, but after a while, it wears on you. Yet he, too, does very well in the trains. I don't think that he makes as much as Charles Crenshaw does, but he does just fine, and he also spends his money on drugs.
Are there turf wars now on the trains between panhandlers competing for good spots?
Absolutely. And they tell the transit police about each other. One transit policeman told us that they, quote, rat like crazy, that they rat on each other all the time. And
to get rid of the competition?
Yes. There's a lot of competition. Some panhandlers subscribe to a certain amount of decorum, and they say that if they see someone else in the car, they'll go to another car. But others sort of walk in, and sometimes you have panhandlers screaming at each other, and all the passengers are sort of looking at each other amazed because, you know, these two panhandlers are screaming at each other in front of them.
This year, there was an initiative on the part of the New York City Transit Police to crack down on panhandling in the subways. Would you just run through what that initiative is about?
Well, panhandling in the New York subways is illegal. You're not allowed to do it. But a great many people have been panhandling anyway. And although the New York City Transit Police Department knows that they're never going to get rid of all the panhandlers, they have been making since, I'd say, I think it began in January, they have been making a concerted effort to get rid of panhandling in the subway, both by arresting panhandlers and consistent aggressive panhandlers who are arrested or sometimes put in jail for up to 10 days. They are also advertising over the radio by saying things like, "Panhandling is illegal, give to charities that help people in need, don't give to panhandlers." And then they have a poster which is in every single subway car in New York City, and that's a lot of subway cars, which says, "Panhandling on the subway is illegal, no matter what you think. Give to the charity of your choice, but not on the subway." And then there's sort of a thought bubble, a white thought bubble with black writing, which goes down, and it's placed in such a way that it comes right sort of out of a seated passenger's head, and it's got sort of an internal monologue. It says, "Uh-oh, come on, not me. Not me. Oh, please, don't come stand in front of me asking for money. Great, now the whole car is staring. What do I do? What do I do? I know, I'll pretend I'm reading my book. Look, I feel bad, I really do, but hey, it's my money, and how do I know what you'll spend it on anyway? I don't. Sorry, no money from me." But the effect of this placard has been, at best, a wash for the transit authority, so far as I could tell. A great many people, me included, were sort of offended that the transit authority was thinking for us, that they were deciding what our impression of panhandling was, and they were deciding for us what to do. It seemed to a great many people that charity is a very personal decision and shouldn't be decided by, quote, government. Other people didn't know that panhandling was illegal, and when they saw these signs, they had the desired effect, which is to give them excuse not to give.
Had you ever given to panhandlers before writing this piece, and did your inclination to give change at all as a result of the research that you did?
Before I started writing the piece, I gave to people for reasons that were entirely whimsical and spontaneous. If I made a connection, a brief sort of spontaneous connection with someone, I gave to them, and that was it. If I had some extra food in my bag and somebody looked hungry, I would certainly offer them the food. Sometimes they'd take it, sometimes they wouldn't. In the course of writing the piece, I learned a great deal about the panhandlers, and one of the more surprising things for me is how many of them are addicted to drugs or to alcohol. For a while, I thought, well, if they're going to use my money and just shoot it up in their arm, or they're just going to drink it, I'm not going to give to them. That's not the sort of behavior I want to support. But the more and more time I spent on the piece, I became more sympathetic to the panhandlers. And I thought that basically my final impression was is that people who are panhandling on the New York subways are not people whose lives are in great shape, no matter what they're spending the money that they receive on the trains for. It's not a happy existence sleeping on a train in New York subway. It's dangerous. It's, in fact, physically painful sometimes. It's an awful and demeaning situation to be walking through cars and asking for money. I don't think you can give to everybody, but I wouldn't necessarily now rule out giving to somebody who I knew was going to spend the money, might spend the money on drugs, because even those people have to eat, and even those people are human beings. So I guess I came full circle, and what I'm doing right now is I'm still giving to some people. My reasons are pretty much the same. They're whimsical. They're spontaneous. If I make a brief connection with someone, I give to them. And if I don't, I don't. You can't give to everybody. There are just too many people. But I think not to give to anyone at all is something that I certainly can't do.
Now, in your article in the New York Times Magazine, you used the names of the panhandlers you write about, and use their pictures, too. There's a little set of portraits in the article. And I was actually surprised that the people who you spoke to, many of whom confessed that they were lying, let you use their name and photo.
So were we, to some extent. There were some people who refused to allow themselves to be photographed, but not very many. And there were quite a few who, you know, seemed absolutely guileless. I did the best I could after talking to them to check up on them independently, whatever information. If they told me they went to a certain school, I'd call the school and see if they really went there. And some people didn't tell me the truth at all. But there were also a great number of people who told us stories about themselves that were absolutely true.
What's one of the more interesting true stories you were told by one of the panhandlers about their real life?
I think the most interesting man was a man named named David Clark. David Clark is a black man. I would say he's in his 40s. I don't know if that's his real name anymore, and I'll try and explain why. His rap on the subway is to talk about a dog and how he had seen a dog once on the subway, and he pulled out some money from his pocket and he gave it to the dog, and he said, if I'd feed a dog, you know, you should feed a human being. And he's got many, many sort of variations on that story, and lots of dog stories, and he's actually very popular on the trains. We met him. We went onto the platform and we talked to him, and he was wearing a baseball cap and he was wearing a long sort of dirty coat. He has a white beard, whitish. Well, it's whitening. There's streaks of white in it. And he said that when he was a little boy, he went to private school in New York City, and he went to several different private schools. And then he transferred to a public high school in New York City when he was a junior in high school, where he played baseball with Rod Carew, the Hall of Fame baseball player. After that, he said that he was offered a contract by the Chicago White Sox to become possibly a Major League Baseball player. He would start in the minors, of course. But he didn't take it because his singing career was more important to him. And he said that he had sung with people like Ronnie Spector of the Ronettes, and that he was offered, you know, a recording contract, but that he didn't take that either. I checked out the story as well as I could with all the institutions that he mentioned, and each institution had no record of him. He had told us about his wife and where she lived and what she did. I tried to get in touch with her. There was no record of her. Called Rod Carew. Rod Carew said he didn't play high school baseball and that he'd never heard of David Clark. We called Ronnie Spector. She couldn't remember any David Clark. It seemed as though none of these people, it seemed that everything that he had told us was untrue. So we published it that way. And then a letter came from someone who had been to a New York City private school with him and had been his classmate, and said that they'd even seen him at a reunion and they wondered where we got our information. And it is true, apparently, at least some of the story is at least true. And it's sort of ambiguous. We just don't know how much of it's true. We don't know if David Clark is actually his real name. We don't know really who he is. But he did go, somebody named David Clark who matches this description did at least go to one private school in New York City, and it makes us wonder about the rest of the story.
You published the names and photos of many of the panhandlers you spoke to. Did that affect them in any way? Have any of them become, quote, celebrity panhandlers? Or are people less willing to give to them now because they've read some of them are actually making up their stories? Any impact?
We hear all sorts of things. I know that the day that the piece came out, that Jose Santos Rico was waving the copy of the New York Times Magazine and walking through and says, "See, New York Times Magazine says it's okay to give to panhandlers," things like that. I know only really, you know, friends and acquaintances of mine. Some of them give more, some of them give less. I remember as the story was coming in, one of the editors at the Times Magazine said that now she gives a lot more once she knows, you know, what these people's lives are really like. I think it all really varies. I mean, the conclusions of the piece are really my personal conclusions, which is that it's such an enormous problem which has to do with so many other social problems in our society that it's almost overwhelming. You can't give to everyone. You can't solve with two bits. You're not going to help solve someone's problems on the train, somebody who really needs help with substance abuse or somebody who really needs an education. But maybe it will make some bit of a difference just for a moment. And so some few more people are giving, but basically people are sticking to what is their own sort of personal decision.
Nicholas Davidoff's article about panhandlers who work the New York City subways was published in the April 24th edition of the New York Times Magazine. This is Fresh Air.